graduated in February of 36. And at that time, several major league ball clubs were holding baseball schools down in Florida. And New York Giants advertised up in the Chicago papers. I think it was the Sporting News, which I got then. And they were holding a baseball school down in Florida. And my dad asked me what I'd like for a graduation present. I said, Pop, I'd like to try and start into professional baseball. So I graduated in February of 36, and a week after I graduated, we headed down to Pensacola, Florida, where the Giants had their baseball school. And of course, there was a flock of young kids down there, and not young, I'm saying 18 to probably 20, 22 in that range there, that were trying to show off their abilities. And I was there for probably, the school lasted, I think, about a month or so. And the Giants signed me out of that baseball school, and that's where I started into my professional baseball career.
And they assigned you then to a
to a minor league ball club in Greenwood, Mississippi. That was in the Cotton States League in 1936. And prior to that time, when they did sign me, I was able to stay with the Giants during their spring training session and enjoyed meeting all of those fellows at the time. And when after the spring training camp was over, then they assigned me to Greenwood, Mississippi when I was 18 years old.
Who else was at the camp? Is there anybody else?
Well, the one that was instrumental in the baseball camp as a whole was Bill Terry. He was the manager of the New York Giants at the time, and he had his coaching staff and people from the ball club holding that school. And beyond that, none of the players were active in the school itself. Except they came in later after the school was over, and then they started in their regular spring training.
Did anybody else who went down there with you, in other words, who were trying out, who were at the school?
I think out of all of the ones that were signed, which if I remember, there was about 25, and I was the only one that, I think I was the only one that progressed through the farm system to the big league.
So did you have a good year in Greenwood?
Well, in Greenwood, I won 12 games and lost 10, which wasn't too bad.
No.
And the next year I played there again. I played 2 years at Greenwood, and then I went to, from Greenwood, I went to Jersey City in the International League. That was AAA and AAA. But there, first year in Jersey City, I hurt my arm in about the first third of the season, and I mostly sat out the whole rest of the year there. And then I played there again and the next year. And then from there, my arm was still giving me trouble, and then they sent me down to Knoxville, Tennessee in the Southern League.
Class A?
That was Class A. And from there, in August, the Giants recalled me to New York, and that's how that was in 1940, and from there I stayed with them the rest of my career.
You must have made a good impression that first year, too. I see you won two games.
Yeah, I was fortunate. Things went well for me in 1940. I remember the first instance starting in the big leagues was in a relief role. And I guess I did pretty well because then they started me a couple of games after that. And I was a fortune, won two ball games.
Had you sat on the bench for a while waiting for a chance to go in as a reliever?
No, I think within a day or so, or maybe it was the first day that I got there, they threw me right into the right into the game.
Was it in New York? Were you on the road?
Yeah, well, New York was against the Brooklyn Dodgers that I relieved against, which was a tough team at that time. Yeah. I think they were winning the pennant.
Well, they certainly, I think they came awfully close in 1940. Yeah, very close to that. What was it like going in that first time? Let's see, you would have been
22 years old. A lot of fellas say they're ecstatic and they'll never forget it and or anything like that. But to me, it was just another ball game. I didn't try to be nervous or excited, and just took it from there.
What were your best pitches when you came?
I had a good curveball. Just a moderate fastball, but I had a real good curve.
Did you take that into the minor leagues, or did you develop it there?
No, I had that. I had that when I was playing high school baseball. I was noted for having a real good curveball.
What was the biggest adjustment from minor league to major league for you?
Oh, I think knowing how to pitch. I mean, rather than you're pitching every batter has some weakness that everybody else tells you about, and from there you have to have good control and try to pitch the spots rather than just getting the ball over the plate, which a lot of people do in the minors. They just throw it over the plate and forget about it. But when you get into the big leagues, you got to know what you're doing up there and pitch the spots. Right, Al Fox the hitter, that's what the name of the game is.
A lot of the batters knew what they
sure,
were doing,
sure.
So you had to know
that's
yourself.
Right. That's right.
So you played in five games, I guess it was, at the tail end of that season, won a couple of games. Did you know you were coming back to the club, to the big club in the spring? Or
well,
you
I,
for
I had hopes I had hopes I would. I know that, but there again, after I was retained by them. I don't think that I really started pitching until well into May. They didn't start using me right at the beginning of the season. So then they started. I started up in May, tail end of May, I think it was, and did pretty well. So
yes,
from there on, I was in the starting rotation.
11-6 would be $1 million salary.
Oh man. I just today with the Cubs signing Morgan here he's won what 60 some ball games and he lost 120 or something
mm-hmm.
like that
right.
And he's
making
$12 million. When I first started playing in the minor leagues, of course this was in 1936, and people can't realize what men were working for back in those days. So my starting salary then was $85 a month. It was only baseball months. So you were working for practically nothing.
Did you come back to Chicago between seasons? And
yes, I always came home. I always worked during the winter at some type of a job. Then in 1940, my father told me, you're not going to be playing ball all your life. So he was a member of the Chicago Board of Trade in the grain business, and he talked me into buying a membership on the Board of Trade in 1940. And he says, at least when you have that, he says, you'll have something to head back to when you're through. And that came in good stead, because when I pursued baseball, I spent 30 some years down at the Board of Trade.
Well, there was a good pitching staff, or there's certainly some big names on the pitching staff that you were on in 41,
well,
42,
of course,
for
we
example.
Had Carl Hubbell
right
there.
Was
Al Schumacher.
Was he approaching the end of his career about that time?
No, he was still a sharp, real sharp pitcher. Of course, I didn't know him when he was really in his prime. I did know him because even with my 5 years in the minors, every spring I went to spring training with the Giants. So all the players I really got to know in those 5 years.
He mentioned Hal Schumacher also.
Hal Schumacher, Cliff Melton. Those are three of the top ones.
Now, 41 was Bill Terry's last year as
that's
manager.
Right,
is that
that's
right?
Right?
The team
right.
hadn't been doing too well for a
no.
Three
I don't.
Or four
I don't
years,
recall
I
where we finished up in. In 41. I think it was. It could have.
My probably, record says fifth.
All right, fifth.
Being below 500.
And if you knew Mr. Terry, he was a real stickler. He was a real tough nut. No nonsense manager.
Well, he grew up under John McGraw.
Yeah,
that may have had something
was,
to do with
and,
it.
Personally, I think that he didn't like to manage. I think that he had enough baseball and he wanted to get into something else. That's my personal information. But he was a fair man, a good man, but no nonsense man. It's all baseball. And then Oddie took over, Mel Ott took over in 1942. Whereas he was an exceptional baseball player, he was a manager, but he was much easier going than Bill Terry was. But he still did a good job. I think we finished third.
That's right.
Did
indeed. It was a big progress over the years before. 85 and 67. That's a good season.
Yeah.
Good
yeah.
season.
But then the war came. Then the war came, and I was gone for three full seasons. And when I came back in 46, I was released out of the Army like in February, and I just headed straight for camp. And being away from baseball for 3 years and trying to get in shape in a month's time just evidently didn't do the job because I hurt my arm badly. And it was
in the same way that you had hurt it earlier?
No. The first time was in the shoulder, but the second time was in the whole tip of the elbow. I flew off there throwing a curveball. They sent me to Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore and operated on it, but it came back where it was feeling great in 1947, but then problems with the shoulder set in, and I could hardly bounce the ball up there, you know, so Giants released me, and then I signed on briefly with the Cubs. They thought I could bring it around, but I couldn't do it, so I didn't want to chance any more playing baseball under conditions
right.
like that, so I just decided to retire and get into business while I still was relatively young.
About 29, I guess.
Yeah.
But you didn't have the opportunity to play ball during the service, I guess. What did you do?
I did play ball at Camp Grant. I was at Camp Grant originally, and we're 1943, we had a real good baseball club there. We had several big leaguers. Don Calloway was one with the White Sox. Gene Hansen, he played with the A's. We had some high minor leaguers, and we had a good ball club there. And we played a lot of the major league clubs that for the benefit of the servicemen. Then the Chicago papers got a hold of it, and they said, these guys aren't supposed to be in the Army for playing baseball, you know. So they really forced the camp to close down the baseball team, and from there on we were shipped out, all separated, and then I went overseas for a year and a half.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the players whom you played with and against during those years. Who was the best hitter that you remember facing?
Well, I'd say Enid Slaughter. was one of the one that he was saying to his car, not to use one of the better hitters. And then on the same club, he had Johnny Myers, and he later came over to us, but then I think it was in 41 he was with St. Louis.
Right.
Oh, Cincinnati had a lot of good ball players. I can't recall the names right now.
Well, there was another. Of course, Cincinnati player came over to the Giants also, Ernie Lombardi.
Oh yeah, Butts, Ernie Lombardi. He was a catcher over there. I mean, he came over to the Giants and caught me in a lot of ball games.
Which was there a catcher you preferred working with?
Well, believe it or not, we had Danny, and then Walker Cooper came over from the Cardinals, and we had Ken O'Day, and we had Bots Lombardi, and when I first came up, we had Gus Mancuso, Ray Berries, who was a pitching coach for the White Sox for a number of years.
I think Gabby Hartner was there.
Gabby Hartner. So all of those, the one I really, believe it or not, like to pitch to is Ray Berries, because he was able to read me pretty well, and we hit it off together. Of course, Gabby used to catch me too, Gabby Hartman. But there again, it's strange when I can remember when I was a 16-year-old kid, you know, and all of these fellows were idols of mine, and then all of a sudden you're instead of being idols, you're talking with them, you're living with them, you're playing cards with them, and it's really strange how things work out.
It certainly is. Was there a particularly big name hitter that you had his number? Can you recall anybody
I really can't recall the teams that, and incidentally, Frank Gustine, who was with Pittsburgh, he was on the same, he and I played on the same high school team here in Chicago.
Oh.
And he went to Pittsburgh, and then of course I went to the New York Giants, which is, don't happen very often.
No, either. No, not out of any high school whatsoever. What was it like in those days with the management and the press and so forth? What sort of course, you were in one of the great media markets of the world. What was it, did you feel the papers treated you and the team fairly most of the time? What kind of coverage was there?
Well, I think the press was, as far as I was concerned, the press didn't bother you too much. I think Bill Terry was real strict with the press. He wouldn't leave them in the clubhouse, you know what I mean? Where they could have the do anything they wanted. Maybe once in a while they let them in, but most of the time the press talked to you pre-game in the dugouts, around the dugouts. So. And of course, when you went on the road, they were usually we traveled by train then, and they were on the same train, and they were able to corral you then and talk to you. But overall, I think they were very fair. Let's put it that way.
I wanted to ask you also what it was like being on the road 50 years ago. A lot different than flying in a chartered jet.
Sure. Carson. Out of New York, some of the shorter hauls we'd bus it, but most of the time it was train.
Like Boston or Philadelphia?
Yeah. Of course, everywhere else coming in, we'd usually leave out of New York, and we'd come to Chicago and then go to St. Louis and go to Cincinnati. From New York to Chicago, that pretty much a 20-hour trip, if I remember right. So it was riding the rails for 20 hours and playing cards or pinochle or whatever you could. While the hours away, it was very, you couldn't do very much. And it was, uh, it it was tough, yeah, especially if you got off the train and you had to go play a ball game because your legs were, a lot of times your legs would swell up from doing all that sitting, and it took you a couple of days to even get shake the ride, you know. But now, what the heck, they hop the plane and they're there in a couple hours, so it's quite a bit different. Of course, everything was, we didn't have anything west of the Mississippi. I mean, there was no clubs out west. All our traveling was from St. Louis east. That was it.
You certainly were at the far end of it. It was a very long train ride to St. Louis.
Yeah, and then and of course, when we come to Chicago, it was 100 in Chicago, and we'd go to St. Louis, it would be 105 in St. Louis, and then we'd go to Cincinnati, which was the ballpark was down in a valley, and it would be 110 there, it seemed like. By the time we got through those three towns, we were really running through the ringer. And of course, in those days, no air conditioning, no nothing. You know, you had to try to keep as cool as you could. I can remember in our hotel rooms, we soak a sheet in a bucket of ice water, you know, and then hang it up somehow and put the fans on the other side of it to blow some cool air into the room. It was all together different than they have it now.
Yeah, sure was. All those different ballparks, was there one that you particularly liked to pitch in?
Well, I pitched in about all of them. The only ones I didn't, let's see. I like to pitch in both St. Louis and Cincinnati. I seem to have good luck pitching in both of those towns. In Boston, the same way, Philly. I liked them all. There was even the Cubs Park. I thought the Cubs Park was a great park. Of course, it was every time we came to Chicago, that's my hometown, so I was able to get back to see Mountain Park. You know.
Was there a ballpark that you felt really didn't suit your style of pitching, or that you thought was a sort of a bad luck park?
Oh, I think Ebbets Field. I didn't particularly like Ebbets Field at the right field. You know, you had that high scoreboard. That it made baseball a little odd playing there because fly balls to right would be wrecking off the right field wall and so forth. I didn't think that was.
What about the rivalry between the Giants and the Dodgers? Did you like the fans in
Ebbets
Field?
That was. Well, we went to play Brooklyn. I mean, none of the smaller pitchers ever got in the games. It was always Hubbell and Schumacher and Melton because they went with experience and everything, because the rivalry was real intense. Real intense.
Important to win those games, wasn't it?
Well, the rivalry was such. I mean, the people from New York fans hated Brooklyn, and Brooklyn hated New York. So it was just one of those rivalries that was down through the year.
Exactly. How good a fielder were you as a pitcher?
Good.
What was the toughest play?
I'd say. Toughest play would probably be covering first on anything hit to the first base side, or maybe swinging bunts on the third base line. Those are the tough plays for a pitcher.
Who was the first baseman most of
the
time?
Well, first year was Babe Young, and the second year was Johnny Mines in 42.
Do you recall a particularly outstanding defensive play that you saw while you were there?
Not really. I've seen every kind of a defensive play there is in baseball. When you watch ball games for 10, 12 years, you know, there's all kinds of good plays.
who had the best outfield arm that you saw while you were there? Anybody stand out?
Well, I mean, the one that was able to really cover his position and know everything about his position probably was Melott, because Fuller Grounds was a tricky right field. Real short mm-hmm. down the line, and then it angled out sharply toward center, and he knew how to play the head, to know how to play the wall, and come up throwing, and I think Ottie did as good a job as anybody. But you had good left fielder, and Joe Moore, he could throw well. Center field, with several center fielders, Hank Leeper, he had a good arm. So all in all, in those days, believe it or not, most of your outfielders had good arms, it seemed like. And nowadays, in going back into the 30s, you had so many minor league teams that were in Class D, Class C, Class B. Every major league club, although there was only 16 major league clubs, they all had, the Cardinals must have had 50 teams. They must have had 50 or more, the Cardinals. The Giants, they sort of got into it in the tail end. They didn't have too many. But you had so many players, and good players or potential players to choose from, that the big league players had to be on their toes all the time, because if they're going to hit 225, like a lot of these ball players are hitting today, 225, they're not going to be around. They didn't stay around.
What are the biggest changes that you see in the game today and the game that game when you played? You touched on a couple of them, but
well, I think they've taken too much away from the pitchers, for one thing. They've lowered the mound. They let guys get up there and take toe holds. You can't pitch them inside. You can't do anything to shake them loose from that home plate. After all, home plate is, it belongs to the pitcher. You know what I mean? And some guys leaning over it and swinging from their heels on a pitch. When I played ball, if somebody did that, the next pitch you could be sitting on the ground, you know what I mean? They got you out of that batter's box. After all, it belongs to the pitcher. Now the pitcher can't do anything, and these guys are going up there and they're swinging from right from their heels, and you can't do anything to shake them loose.
I suspect that you watch some ball games on TV, and I don't know if you get into games in the city or not.
All the time.
What about the strike zone?
Well, I think it's I think a lot of pitches that belt high, a little higher than belt high, they're all balls.
What was the top of the strike zone?
I think in my time it was they gave you a little more of the strike zone belt high. It was a strike, but now it seems like you're limited to about 8 or 10 inches, and they don't give you anything up behind your belt. I think it's there's another thing I think is taken away from the pitcher. But mainly is that these hitters think they can get up there and, you know, they can keep unwinding and winding, and then when they hit one over the fence, they stand there and look at it going over the wall. They don't even run, you know what I mean?
What would have happened to the next batter if somebody had done that?
You know what would have happened to him. He'd have been, his cap would have been up there, but he wouldn't have been there.
He's down in the spot position.
I mean, that's just showing up. We call it showing somebody up. And it wasn't, nobody did it.
I'm surprised sometimes when I see that pitcher who's been thrown a new ball by the umpire doesn't drill the runner as he's heading towards first base. Mm-hmm. What would they do to him if they did?
They'd fine him, throw him out the game, and soak him about $5,000 is what they do to him. But now you throw at them and the umpire says the next time you're out of the ball game, or maybe even throws you out right then and there. You can't do a damn thing about it. So I think there's more ways than getting a guy out of the box by, you don't have to throw at his head. I mean, he's got feet too, you know. You can get him out of there in a number of ways. You can, his arms, just throw inside, but you don't have to throw at his head. But you got to be able to move somebody out of that box where they just don't dig in and have all the advantages they do have.
Well, that brings up another topic, and that is umpires. You know, Al Bartlett came up in 1941,
yeah,
about the same year that you
did.
I
was a good friend of Al's. He was a nice guy. And another umpire, I was trying to think of his name. He was with us at Camp Grant. He was in the Army, too. I can't recall his name. He was a nice coach, too. The umpires was the only one. There were several umpires. One I couldn't get along with, and a lot of other players couldn't get along with. I don't know if you remember the name Major Kurt.
Yeah, George Major Kurt.
Yeah. Oh, he just, to me, I was always in trouble with him, you know.
Did he give you the thumb once?
Oh,
yeah.
Sure. He just, the ball would be right down the middle of the plate, you know, and he'd, ball, and you know, you take it a couple of times, and then you lose your cool, you know. You go, and then he makes some smart remark to you, so you got to retort, you know. You just can't let him push you around. So I was thrown out several times, but I wasn't the only one. Of course, a lot of those times you had umpire crews on your train, you know, as you were traveling. They didn't go by themselves like they go now. They're on different flights and everything else. But at that time, a lot of the umpiring crews rode your trains.
Did they eat with you then, too, and play cards, or was there some separation?
Well, there was some separation, but you always got, there was always a time when you got, some of them got together. But most of the time, they were separated. But you'd run into them in the, and the diners, because everybody went to the, ate in the diners, the passengers, the ball players. I mean, nobody was separated when you went to eat in the diners.
I'm sure. We talked a little bit about the style of managers, Bill Perry and Mel Ott. Do you think that Mel Ott might have had a better record as a manager had it not been for the war? Do you think he would have played as long as he did if it hadn't been for the war?
I doubt it. I think he probably would not have played during the war. I mean, most of your better players were drafted.
Were you drafted early?
Well, in 42 season, but I got my draft notice sort of like the first third of the season. I had my draft notice, and I didn't know whether I was going next week or the next month or whatever. I was out of Chicago and I was in New York, and then they let me finish the season. I wasn't drafted until the tail end of 42.
Well, sounds pretty unsettling, wasn't it?
Oh, it was.
What was it like in the clubhouse for those people who knew they were going or didn't know if they were going?
You can imagine, put yourself in the same position. You didn't know what the hell you were doing, and what was, if you're going to be around next week or next month or what. I can remember the 42, the next to the last game of the season. I think it was Boston that we were playing, and the fans got in the ball game by bringing 10 pounds of steel for the war effort. Of course, we must have had 40,000-50,000 people that were in the ball game, and I think I had them beat 4-1 going into the ninth inning. And then the fans started coming out of the stands, and they went on the field, and they couldn't clear the field. So the umpires forfeited the game. All I had to get was three more batters out. I had my 12th ball game won, you know. Instead of I lost 9-0.
Oh, gee. Well, there were no night games during 1942, were there?
Yeah, I think there were. Yeah.
On the East Coast.
I don't remember.
I'd read someplace that that they didn't want the lights
maybe
going.
Maybe it could well be. But I remember like in 40. See, very few night games. You never played less than a dozen for the whole year. Everything was day. Most of it was day ball. I would agree that probably there weren't any night games in 42 because we had blackouts and everything. And a lot of nights there when they were testing their air raid capacity and so forth. So probably that was true.
It must have been. Let's see. There were two instances I think when the Giants had ball games interrupted or delayed by radio broadcasts. One was a speech by Roosevelt, and another one I think was in Pittsburgh for a prize fight, of all things. Do you remember those at all? Okay. I've read about those, but I've never met anybody who might have been there during that time. Who would be could you pick an all-star team? Of those years that you played, who was the best first baseman you saw? You mentioned Mize, for example.
Of course, you had a real good one in Chicago, Phil Cavaretta. Mm-hmm. He was as good as they came. And you had, of course, you had Dolph Camilli with Brooklyn, and Johnny Mize. I think you had Frank McCormick. I think was his name at Cincinnati.
Right.
Who we had in Pittsburgh. But I would say overall, I would say that Johnny Mize for power, and Phil Cavaretta was a good glove man. He was a good hitter too, but he wasn't the power type hitter. Like a guy like Mize. He was a good ball player. In fact, Phil Cavaretta was playing in Chicago schools when I was playing too. There he came from Chicago High School.
On the second base.
Billy Herman was pretty much winding up his career then, but he was a real good second baseman too. Shortstop, he had several of them. Billy Jurgis, Pee Wee Reese. Those are two of the better ones.
And third, let's see, was Dick Bartell on the team?
Dick Bartell was with me, and then Billy Werber.
That's right.
Billy Werber. And both of those were good first baseman. Dick Bartell was a peppery type of guy that you would like to have on your team at any time.
I've heard that.
Was always in the game, hollering and keeping you on your toes. He was a real good.
He just put a book out. I don't know.
I heard about it, but I haven't.
Rowdy Richard, I think, is the name of it.
Yeah, I saw a picture of him on TV. Somebody was interviewing him on TV when he did put the book out, and. Wouldn't be able to recognize him, you know what I mean? He was so old and shriveled. Of course, I would probably say the same thing about myself if somebody saw me. They probably wouldn't recognize me either. Remembering him the last time you seen him 50-some years ago, and then seeing him when he's 80, I think he was 85 or 86 now. A great change took place, but he's still alive.
Yes, he certainly is. You mentioned Harry Danning a little bit earlier. You probably know he lives fairly close
I
to here.
I heard that Harry lives over here in Valparaiso,
exactly.
Indiana.
Exactly.
And I heard the Cubs announcer interview him one time at the before Cubs ball game, but I was rather surprised because Harry originally came from California to see him settled in here at Valparaiso. It's a surprise.
You'd expect it to be the other way, born in Indiana and retiring in California.
Yeah, but Harry was he was from the old school, you know, when they had the real good Giant teams in the 35 and 36. Or was it 35, I think they went up there, whenever it was. But he was a good catcher.
Right. Harry the horse.
Yeah.
Well, if I've been asked to ask you this question, if you owned a ball team, you mentioned Dick Bartel being the kind of player you'd want to have. If you owned a ball team, who are some of the players that you would want to have on it that you played with? And maybe there's somebody from today that you would put in that same category also.
Well, I'd sure like to have a third baseman like Stan Hack. He was with the Cubs. Shortstop Billy Jurgis or Dick Bartel. Second base would be a player like the Cubs have now, Sandberg. I would think that he would fit on any ball club. Same way with Dawson in the outfield. He would fit in with anybody. You have players today that I think are superb. They would have been good ball players in any period of baseball. There are some that I think they're playing today that would have a hard time playing 40 years ago because of their batting average. I mean, you couldn't hit in the high 280s or 300, you weren't around, and you wouldn't have been playing.
Well, you think they just don't know the strike zone? You think they're trying all to be long ball hitters?
That's what I say. They're hurting themselves by going up there and swinging from their heels every time they get in there. I mean, you had good ball players, Nellie Fox, Mel Ott, line drive hitters that were hitting 300 all of the time. They weren't swinging from their heels. But nowadays, ball clubs don't want an outfielder unless he can hit 25 home runs. But they don't care whether he can hit 25 home runs and hit 210, and they still pay him millions of dollars. But somebody that hits 300, we don't want him. He's a good hitter, but all he's doing is hitting singles. We want the runs. They're willing to pay millions to somebody that can hit 25 home runs. And I think if you have a ball club that has 300 hitters that hit line drives, I think they're going to win a hell of a lot more ball games than these guys that are going to strike out 100 times and hit 25 home runs.
Well, the Giants were able to hit some home runs in like 46 and 47. There were some really good home run hitters at that time. But they didn't win the pennant either of those years.
Well,
unfortunately.
Well, it takes, pitching. I still think that pitching is the name of the game. If you got four or five, four good pitchers that can pitch in rotation and keep healthy, that wins more ball games than your 25 home run hitters win for you.
Were there any relief specialists?
We had a big guy in New York named Older Brown. He was a tremendous.
Jumbo Brown?
Jumbo Brown. He was, God, he must have weighed 300 pounds. Big, heavy set guy, but he did he was a good reliever, and then we had another one after him, Ace Adams. He was a good reliever, but it was altogether different then. I mean, if you were a starter, and you got knocked out within the first three innings of a ball game, the next day you were in the bullpen. I mean, you didn't have specialists, so-called specialists, like you have now. Next day, you were the guy that's going to get in the ball game of
the mop-up man.
Yeah. Now, you get knocked out. Well, you just wait your turn the next 4 or 5 days. But there, you had a job to do. And next day, you could bet you were in the bullpen.
There was a pitching coach for the Giants.
Dolph Lukey.
How valuable were coaches in those days? I've heard different reports from people.
I would say they're much more specialized now than they were then. I mean, although Mr. Lukey, he was a relief pitcher in his day. He pitched for, I think, Cincinnati more than anybody. He was with the Giants some of the time, but he would sit down and talk to you. What I mean, and talk to you how to pitch the hitters and so forth, which at that time I don't think he had a lot of coaches that maybe they'd sign an old catcher, you know what I mean?
Right. As I say, I've heard varying reports on how valuable the coaches were, but that you're the first I've heard you say you thought the coaches may have done more damage than...
I'm saying the manager.
The manager, I'm sorry. The manager.
The manager. Because I think in those days you didn't have pitching coaches that could help a manager out. In other words, the manager was the guy that he ran the ball club. And a lot of times he put pitchers in when he shouldn't have put them in. I mean, when I hurt my arm in Jersey City, Travis Jackson, he's in the Hall of Fame. He was running the ball club. He's a shortstop, third baseman. But here one night I pitched the whole ball game, and the next night we were playing a team, and he comes up to me and he says, "Bob, can you pitch an inning?" I'm only 20 years old. What can I tell him? What can I tell him? I said, "Sure, I think I can do it." So I run down to the bullpen, and I throw two pitches, and the batter hits into a double play, and I'm in the ball game, and I haven't even warmed up, and my arm is stiffer than the board, and I go out there and throw a couple of balls, and just like a stick broke, you know, and there, and then I'm out for the whole season, you know what I mean? My arm never did come back to what it was when I was 20 years old. And there's a perfect example of an infielder trying to run a pitching staff.
The infielder can play every day, so I guess he assumes everybody else can.
That's right. That's right, exactly. And I think there's one you could see. I think he had a perfect example with the Cubs, with Popeye. I mean, you know, you get a guy that's going good for you, and he saves a game for you one day, he's in there the next day, he's in there the next day, he's in there the next day, maybe six games in a row. Then they finally get to him, and then he won't use them for 10 days, you know what I mean? Instead of one day on, one day off, one day on, one day off, and let the guy have some semblance of strengthening his arm and keeping his arm in halfway decent shape. They just pitch you to death, and all of a sudden you can't even comb your hair, and then they wonder what the hell happened. You know?
And it's goodbye.
And that's right. He's interested in winning ball games. He's not interested in saving your arm. That's the way I look at it. And I think a pitching coach, when he runs the ball game, he should go up to the manager and say, "This is how we're going to do it, and this is the way this is the way the pitching staff should be run. Now the manager says, okay, he can pitch today, tomorrow, the next day, and the next day. No. That's not the way to use pitching.
So the pitching coach then acts not only as an advisor to the manager and an advisor to the player, but sometimes like a buffer between the pitchers and the manager, right?
Right. But nowadays you've got specialists, that so-called specialists that come, are supposed to go in there and pitch an inning or two innings. But that don't mean anything. He may have warmed up three times in the bullpen. Maybe that's three innings, too. He goes in and pitches two more innings. That's five innings. The next day is in the same thing. The next day, and then your arm, you haven't got it. It isn't a piece of rubber. It's just a muscle and everything else, and it got to rest, just like anything else has got to rest after activity.
Mel Ott was a playing manager, and of course Bill Terry was not playing at that time. Am I right?
No, yeah. He wasn't.
Did that change, did the approach to the ball club change because of that in any way, the fact that Ott was out there on the field?
Well, it didn't seem to. I mean, he still wound up in third base. Yeah. A fellow that was as successful as Mel Ott was, it's hard to tell yourself you're through, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I think that had a lot to do with it. He felt good, he still could do it, but there again, how many things can you do? You can't play, you can't manage, you can't do everything and do them well.
I read one time that he admitted he was almost hit by a fly ball because he was busy thinking about strategy out there.
That's what I'm trying to grab.
And you know, in those days too, the manager could make as many trips to the mound as he wanted to, and I suspect he kind of wore his legs out.
There was no minimum or maximum number of times you could go out to the mound. No, I think it's very difficult. Lou Boudreau did it with Cleveland. There's exceptions to everything, but I think it's a tough to do two things at once.
There may have been more playing managers who were infielders than playing managers who were outfielders.
Yeah. That.
I know that Ott was the first one, maybe since Chris Speaker, which would have been almost 20 years before.
Yeah. Well, most of them, Charlie Grimm was the best, but I don't think he played and managed. I think he was still playing when he managed.
I think that's right.
It's tough. I don't see how you can do it.
How did you like him as a manager? You played under three
great managers. He was a nice guy. Charlie was a fun guy. Baseball and everything, but he never took it too serious. He was a great guy.
Well, towards the end of your career, there are a couple of things that were just happening. I thought I'd ask you about them. First of all, the Mexican League. Well, were you approached by the Pasquale brothers? I know a lot of Giants were.
Yeah,
and
I know
that
they were.
Decimated the team.
I know they were. But at that time, you're going into 40, I believe it was in 46, wasn't it? 46, well, that's when I had my arm operated on. I was walking around in a sling most of the year, so I never had any approach by the Mexican League officials, no, but a number of them did.
Were they pretty open about it, or was it the players closed-mouthed about being approached by the Pasquale brothers?
Well, you know, when I was... walking around the sling, I wasn't going to the ballpark as much as I could do anything. So I wasn't as close to any of those players, and I really don't recall them. Recall it being out in the open. It was pretty much a surprise when it did happen. Like Ace Adams said, boy, he threw the coop and up the flat, and even. I guess Sal Mabry, he went. And
a player, I hope you can tell me something about Danny Gardella.
He wasn't there when I was there.
Oh. I my mistake, and I thought he was. At the time, he must have just almost overlap, but not quite. Well, there was something else that happened towards the end of your time in the majors, and that was the breaking of the color line. Jackie Robinson, I guess, went to Montreal in 1946, and then to the Dodgers in 47.
That was the year I quit, in 47. So all of my baseball playing, minors and majors, was strictly in the white player. There weren't any 47. Robinson came up with Brooklyn, and that was the first year. But
you recall any reactions of what apparently was going to happen?
I'm sure you can imagine. I'm sure that we had mixed reactions. Some of them didn't give a damn, but then others did. We had a lot of Southern players, Southern people have a different, at that time, had different ideas about black people. I mean, when I played in Mississippi for 2 years, I mean, you can't imagine you can't imagine how black people were treated, you know? As human beings in a lot of instances at all.
There were separate sections in the right?
Sure. They could only sit on the outfield bleacher section where I see any place they could sit.
Did you play against any barnstorming Negro League teams or black teams?
No. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I know. We didn't. One year we did go to a prison out here in Joliet, and we played the prison inmates ball game, and we played a few blacks on the team, but we didn't play any barnstorming. I never did play any barnstorming.
Was that an option that you had, or were you asked to be on one of those teams after the season was over, or how did that work?
I think, Bob Feller did quite a bit of it, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he handpicked his players that he wanted, you know what I mean? That's the way I think it was done. I never was asked. I don't think I would have won in the first place. I figured playing baseball was long enough, 6 months is long enough to play it without going out there.
Time to go home and recuperate.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, you only had a couple of months to recuperate. You got home in October, middle October, in December I was already working out again, you know, in Hawaii and so forth, and keeping halfway decent shape.
Did most of the players try to stay in shape during the winter?
Some of them did. Some of them came to spring training all ballooned up.
Spring training is where they were going to get in shape.
Yeah, but I never did believe it. I always gave myself a couple of months of rest, and then I went right back into training. Except the last year. Last year, in 47, I didn't, and I suffered more from that, and maybe that's where I had my arm trouble, because I didn't do it then, because my wife was pregnant, and I figured I couldn't chance, you know, going off the hours at a crack when leaving her alone, so I didn't do it. And I sure suffered in spring training, because I'm in shape at all.
The Giants trained in two different places in 41 and 42, didn't they? Where did they, in 42, it was what, Jersey City or something like that?
No. Where the hell did
they had to train in the north, didn't they, in 42? Because of the war?
I don't remember ever training in Jersey City. I think maybe that was in 43.
43 maybe?
43 maybe. Was it in 42?
Was it down south in 41 and maybe 42 also?
Yeah, I think it was down in Florida, down in 41. Because you your war in 42, you know, Pearl Harbor took place December, you know what I mean? 42, you weren't being hammered that much, you know, I mean.
That adjustment had to
happen. It hadn't, I mean, it wasn't all-out war in 42. Then when you get toward the middle of the season, it began to pick up and get more of a grip on you. But going into 42, I'm sure we had a regular spring training. 43, I think it was, they had to go up north. I'm sure we didn't do it. Then after the war, I think we went to Arizona, I think, in 46. Good training in the board.
Do you recall any particularly humorous incident?
Not really. I mean, I don't recall. I'm sure a lot of funny things happened, but I don't. I have a sort of a risk in my mind that
any big rhubarb or fight on the field that comes to mind?
No, we seem to be devoid of that. We never heard that kind of trouble.
Well, you had a nice guy as a manager, I certainly heard that in L.I.
Oh, yeah. He was a nice guy.
Yeah.
So was Terry, but I mean, we never, I don't recall any rhubarb or the medical. I don't recall any time where the benches are, you know, like they have now, bench cleared. Because things that happen, when I say somebody gets knocked down, that was part of baseball.
It was expected.
I mean, if you were going to, somebody knocked you down, you could just go bet. You didn't have to go up to tell the pitcher, look, he just knocked me down. The pitcher, but you knew he had a job to do, you know what I mean? Nobody had to tell him. But they never went after the best hitter on the ball club or anything. The next guy that got up there got it, you know what I mean? We'll wait for him. We'll pick him out, you know. Or maybe if the pitcher, they thought the pitcher was doing it on his own, maybe they waited until he got up there to knock him down. The way the ball game was played. Of course, I've seen a lot of players get hit and hurt badly, but I don't think it was intentional. The ones I saw get hit were hit because the ball got away from the pitcher more than anything else. It wasn't in the throwing, was it?
Those were pre-batting helmet days, too.
We didn't have any helmets. I know in Jersey, when I was playing in Jersey City, a fellow named Abernathy, boy, he got plucked in the head and the ball just stuck in his head, you know what I mean, and dropped right at his feet. And he damn near, he was throwing, he had to leave baseball. He damn near died from it, too.
Well, another change that I'm very aware of, changing glove. What was your glove like?
Oh, it was a pretty good glove.
You mean for the day? I mean, it's not like one of those basket things today.
No, but it was, I had a pretty big glove. It wasn't like you see in some of the early baseball where they were only little gloves. They were pretty ordinary gloves. Now they're a lot more fancier and larger. But they were always the old, plain old leather. That's all it was. And players at that time were reluctant to break in new gloves. You know, they'd rather have their old faithful with them for a long time before they break in new gloves. Maybe catchers, but fielders like to save their gloves because they got used to them.
Can you describe your pitching motion?
That's three quarter, what you call three-quarter pitcher. That's between a sidearm, and then it was strictly overhand. It was right in the middle. It was my pitching motion, I believe.
Did you rear, you were a right-hander. Did you rear back on your right leg a lot, or a moderate kick, or?
No, I wasn't a, high kicker. No. If you've seen the way Hubble pitched, you've seen probably some pictures of him. I think I pitched pretty much the same order he did.
Was he a model for you as you were growing up?
I mean, he was so successful that I tried to pattern myself after him.
You could do a lot worse.
Yeah, so the way he pitched, and without going through all that falter off, throwing you, kicking your foot over your head and all of that, he was a type of a guy that was pretty straightforward without any real out-of-the-way motion. So
and very successful, too.
Do
you have any ball games that you pitched in that you particularly remember being, you mentioned that one that you had to forfeit, unfortunately. But did you remember one in particular? It was something like a 1-0 battle, or you had a no-hitter going for 7 innings, or you lost
the one
there.
I had a ball game. St. Louis, I think I was winning 3-0. 3-0, I had 2 outs in the 9th inning, and I wound up losing the damn thing. And a couple of errors, and then the final error, the right fielder picked the ball up and was throwing to home plate, and he threw it clear into the stands on a fly, and before it was all over, 4 runs scored.
That
really knocked me down. But it comes with baseball.
Sometimes the other team will do that.
Sure.
Did you win any games with your bat?
Oh, it was a pretty good hit. Maybe my average didn't show it, but I still was able to win a number of my ball games.
Brought in a pinch hitter?
No. They didn't have an easy out when I was up there.
They didn't have to pinch hit for you either.
No. There was a number of ball games that I helped win my own ball games. Of course, I played ball all my life. What I wanted to do ever since I was about 13, 14 years old is play baseball. That's all I wanted to do.
Well, after you got out and went in on the board of trade, did you stay involved in baseball while coaching or
baseball program here for the kids, what we call the boys club here in Evergreen Park. I was active in that for about 10 years, managing, being vice president of the organization, getting all the sponsors in the uniforms. And we had 36 teams, I think, here in the village, different age groups, all the way from 7 years old all the way through 15. So we had a lot of baseball here in the park.
Well, were you born in Chicago and then moved here?
Chicago's right.
Just
another mile down the road. You know, I was born and raised in Chicago. I moved out here when I quit playing baseball.
Was there somebody in this area then who influenced you in baseball, or was there a coach or somebody like that really got you going as a youngster?
Oh, I just love to play baseball. One of my cousins was a very good fellow. His brother played on the Chicago Fire. He always, I think they call him that. He was a fireman, and they had good baseball teams. But you got to remember, back in the 30s, you were in a depression. people didn't have any money. And every Sunday, I don't care what park you went to in the city of Chicago, you could find ball games. All kinds of ball games. You never had a diamond. In fact, you had to get permits well in advance of the time you're going to play in order to be sure that you're going to get the diamond. And baseball was just everywhere you went, there was baseball. In the morning, there was softball games. In the afternoon, the ordinary league games came out. Everybody, and you had crowds that came out to these ball games. So, and now you go out, you can't even find a ball game in a park now. Nobody plays it.
It was a sad story in Los Angeles. I was reading this today. They cleared out a place for a ball diamond.
I read that.
Did you read that? And the neighbors are complaining about it.
We had a big area over here. When I was in Boys Club here, we had a big park half a mile down the road. That was a square block, and it had, what did it have? It had about four diamonds on it. We wanted to put lights up there so they could play at night. And then in the winter we could turn it into ice skating and things like that and make use of the park. We went over there and tried to get those lights in, and those residents around there, they damn near killed us. They damn near killed us. Had a brand new car out there, and somebody come along and stuffed it with sugar. I mean, that's how vehement they were about all we were doing it was for the benefit of the kids. The people, they think more of their property than they do their kids. Nowadays, I think they wish that maybe they did. they'd have been better off if they had
invested in the wrong thing. Well, what have I missed?
Well, you go to the, like I started in playing ball when I was just turned 18 and quit just before I was 30. It was a good 12 years of my life, interrupted by 3 years in the Army, but it was a part of my life that I enjoyed. I wouldn't trade it for anything, but it's over. When it was over, I realized I had to go on and raise a family and try and be successful in other ways.
Was it your decision that it was over, or did the Cubs
The Cubs wanted to, they wanted to take me into spring training the next year. They suggested I go with them the next year. But I was 30 years old, and in those days when you reach 30 in baseball, you were downhill.
Yeah.
I mean, now they play until they're 40. But in those days, if you played 30 or 32, they always had the 20-year-old kids coming up. You couldn't stick around any longer than that.
Yeah, I hope that Carlton Fisk and Nolan Ryan keep on playing, because they're the only ones left who are older than I am.
Well, and then, what is it, Winfield? Winfield's
about 40, I guess.
Yeah, sure. But that was unheard of. And then too, when I quit playing ball when I was 30, I could remember when I was 22 years old and playing in AAA, and you had fellows that were 36, 37, 38, still trying to make some money out of playing baseball, and I didn't want to become a baseball bum, you know what I mean? That's what I considered fellows that didn't know they were through, and they just kept plugging along, and
unlike you, didn't have anything else to go to.
Well, they didn't want to try. I mean, I didn't have anything to go to either, but I had to work my way up and show that I had the ability to do something, you know? So I think that I seen too many of those guys around, and I didn't want to be one of those, so that's it. Sad. I had a wife and a kid, and when you have a kid and you're on the road living out of a suitcase for 6-7 months, that isn't the best way in the world to try and rear a family. That's fun. Everything is great when you're single and you're young, But when you get married and they have children, it's a tough life.
The priorities change.
How can you, if your kids are in school, how can you bring your family to where you're playing? I mean, you gotta have two homes, and got a wife without a husband, kids without a father. It's a tough life, and it's a tough life.
I presume you roomed with somebody in a hotel in New York?
I roomed with, there was a hotel in New York called the, but anyway, there was several of ball players lived there, and we roomed together. I roomed with Johnny Rucker, and Willard Marshall. And I even stayed there in 42 when I got married because they had my kitchenette apartments in Canada. We stayed there. The Alamac was the name of it, 72nd and Broadway.
Well, I appreciate very much your sharing all of this with me. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that I should have asked you? I always try to give
believe
a person
it or
opportunity
not,
to do
believe
that.
Believe it or not, this is the first time I've taught baseball like I've taught here. I don't recall how many years it's been. I mean, I have a son and a daughter. My son is never played professional baseball, but he played a lot of baseball. But it seems when you have a son, they just take it for granted. They don't even ask you about your baseball past or anything like that. Maybe neighbors come up and ask you different things. It's a part of your life that's been, and you put it in your the back of your mind, and that's where it stays.
Do you have any memorabilia? Do you keep your uniform or your glove or a ball that you won a special game with? Or
I've got a lot of stuff that I saved from baseball.
I know. I brought it down. Not very.
Well, it looks heavy, certainly. Oh, golly.
You asked a lot of
treasure trove.